It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Harry Enten from 538.com is back for our weekly look at the presidential race, including today's new survey numbers here in Wisconsin. First, yesterday was the partisan primary election in Wisconsin. There were local elections all over the state, as well as primaries for the U.S. House and Senate, and for state senators and representatives. Susan Johnson joins us now to talk about the election results and the road ahead. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to do it.
Well, were there any surprises in last night's election results here in Wisconsin?
Actually, no. I felt like after looking at the results, I didn't see anything that was really surprising to me.
And yeah, we had a lot of places where there were much talked about challenges to incumbents. The incumbents won. In general, is that something about Wisconsin, or was this just not a year where there were serious, credible challengers?
Well, I think nationwide, we haven't really seen a lot of the big stories. States that have had primaries already, where we've seen a lot of incumbents getting upset. And not only did incumbents win, but in many cases, they won quite handily.
Speaking of winning handily, Paul Ryan had this challenge from Paul Nealon. Got a lot of national attention. Sarah Palin said, Paul Ryan's going to get cantered for not embracing the Donald Trump campaign. What made this election different than the one where Eric Cantor, a prominent Republican in the House, lost his seat in a primary?
Well, I think, for one, the fact that Eric Cantor was cantored gave Paul Ryan something to pay attention to. So I think that that was very important. I think that the other big difference is that Paul Ryan has never lost his sense of where he's from. One of the tags that Eric Cantor had labeled him was that he really went to Washington and became of Washington. And so his opponent could, I would say, rightly argue that he really wasn't of the district anymore. Paul Ryan is the opposite of that, and he campaigned a lot for re-election, and he knew that there was this challenge. So I think that's another big difference.
So some Trump supporters had supported Paul Nealon. Donald Trump had held off briefly on an endorsement for Paul Ryan, said nice things about the contender. Is there any kind of indication in Wisconsin or anywhere that Donald Trump is going to help or hurt Republican candidates?
Well, from everything I've been reading, people are really concerned that he's going to hurt Republican candidates. I don't know to what extent he had an impact on this race. I would tend to minimize his impact on this race. If anything, what it did was it helped raise Paul Nealon's profile to a certain degree, and maybe it helped him get a few more votes. But generally what I'm hearing nationwide is that candidates are working really diligently to disavow themselves from Trump, not run in tandem with him.
In all of our races where we had an incumbent, that incumbent is still in the general election now. Given how Wisconsin has been redistricted, setting aside the race to replace Reed Ribble, are any of those other districts really at play this year?
I don't think so, and I think it gets back to that case, as you said, because of the redistricting, that so many of those districts have been drawn to be either a safe Republican or a safe Democratic district. So aside from that open seat, I don't know that any of the incumbents have a whole lot to worry about.
And looking at that open seat, the 8th District, Republican Reed Ribble said he's not running again, said he would not support Donald Trump for the presidency. Now we've got a Democrat and Republican selected in that race. This is the only seat that's been close to switching, really, in the last couple of elections. What do you look for in that seat in the Green Bay area?
Well, I think that given that the Green Bay area has been sort of a swing area in the state, it's not surprising that that's one that potentially could go either way. I would expect that given the concern from the Republicans for holding on to their House majority and the eagerness of Democrats to try to pick up seats, we're probably going to see quite a bit of national attention, even in terms of money and support coming into that district, because the Democrats, especially with the Trump candidacy, are looking at picking up perhaps more seats in the House than they had before, and the Republicans are playing defense. So I'd expect there to be some attention to that district from both parties.
We're talking to political scientist Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at yesterday's primary election results and the road ahead to November. Senate candidate Russ Feingold won pretty handily against a primary challenger yesterday. Now it's officially a race between former Senator Feingold and current Senator Ron Johnson. Speaking of national attention, that seems like we're going to get a lot of that here in Wisconsin. What are you looking for?
Oh, I definitely agree. The Democrats need to pick up 4 or 5 seats to take control of the Senate, depending on who wins the presidency. And so there's going to be a lot of attention on that seat in particular. Some of the recent polls have showed Feingold with a decent-sized lead, but I would expect that that's going to tighten up a bit as things tend to in the fall. And I would expect a lot of national attention on that race.
We've seen some presidential campaign visits to Wisconsin already since the convention. A lot of times, candidates want to have themselves out there with the presidential candidate. This time, we have Hillary Clinton, who would be the most disliked candidate in recent presidential history. If it weren't for Donald Trump, who has higher unfavorable numbers, are candidates for Senate in Wisconsin going to want to really have themselves up on the stage with Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump?
Well, so far, we've seen Ron Johnson decide to not attend an event in Green Bay with Donald Trump. I expect that to continue. Given that Bernie Sanders did so well and had such a strong base of support in Wisconsin, I would think that Hillary Clinton might want to come and attach herself to Russ Feingold. And I would expect that in the fall we will see a joint appearance between Feingold and Hillary Clinton, even with her negatives notwithstanding.
We have all these congressional races, that Senate race, the race for the state legislature. Of course, we had primaries there, so all those races are set now. Republicans control it out, and all now Democrats hoping to maybe take the state Senate. How much of a coattail effect do we usually get, setting aside this year's candidates? How big an impact do presidential candidates usually have on Wisconsin voting?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, as we well know, Democratic candidates tend to do very well in presidential election years, and not so well in non-presidential election years or that midterm election. So given that it's a presidential election year and Hillary Clinton's lack of popularity, again, notwithstanding, particularly given Donald Trump's also the issues regarding Donald Trump, I would expect a larger Democratic turnout, and that could potentially help Democrats down ballot. On the other hand, given the redistricting and gerrymandering that's gone on, some of those seats are just really safe, and it would take a whole lot for some of them to flip.
There's a lot of talk about this being a weird election year, largely, I think, because of Donald Trump's unconventional campaign. As a political scientist watching this, how much do you think the normal rules apply in this election, especially here in Wisconsin? How much is there a chaos factor that could overthrow what we usually think is going to happen?
I think when we look at it nationally and the idea of the presidential election, I think there is a potential chaos factor, and no one knows what's going to happen from day to day. But I think once you get further down ballot with some of those assembly and state senate races, for example, they're going to be running their own campaigns, and they're going to be working to get out the vote of the people within those districts. And while it is very different this year with two candidates at the top of the ticket who aren't seen very favorably, I think that given that down-ballot candidates know that, they're going to be working extra hard to get their voters out and still bring in victories for themselves.
And I'll have to go get a trademark on the phrase chaos factor. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She joined us to talk about yesterday's primary election results in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, this school year marks the 40th anniversary of the court-ordered desegregation of Milwaukee Public Schools. We'll talk to an education expert who says many of the problems that desegregation was supposed to solve still exist. Some are worse. First, there are new numbers out in Wisconsin politics with today's Marquette Law School poll, just in time for our weekly check-in on presidential politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. The results in that poll, a big lead for Hillary Clinton among likely voters. She leads Donald Trump 52-37% in a one-on-one matchup. That's a 15-point lead. Throw in Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, Libertarian and Green, respectively. Clinton still has a 13-point lead among likely voters. Harry Enten is with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Harry, these results were presented live, and they were live tweeted. Here was a bonus tweet in their feed today. Quote, audible audience reaction to news Clinton is up 15 points among likely voters. Harry, did you have an audible reaction to that news?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was getting Chinese food while those results were being tweeted out. But no, I mean, look, this is a state, Wisconsin, which although, as the previous guest had spoken about, leans Republican in midterm elections and presidential years, not so much. It hasn't voted for a Republican candidate for president since 1984. But I will say the fact that Clinton's up by so much, 13 or 15 percentage points, that matches with a lot of the national data we're seeing, which shows that Clinton has a sizable lead on Donald Trump.
That lead among likely voters in a two-way field, that's an 11-point increase compared to July. In a four-way race, it was a 6-point increase. That's a pretty big jump. I mean, are we looking at conventions? Are we looking at Donald Trump's bad week? What do you think is behind that?
Well, I would say a few things. You know, the jump among registered voters was slightly less than it was among likely voters. So there are, I think, a few things that are going on there. Yes, there are some voters who had previously said that they were voting for Trump who might now say they're voting for Clinton. Or maybe they weren't decided and they're going to Clinton, or they were for Trump and now going undecided. So that's part of it. But I think what's also part of it is that if you're hearing a lot of the news over the past few weeks, if you're a Republican voter, you have to feel mighty depressed with what Donald Trump has been saying, while Democratic voters, I think, feel like their party is together. And what the likely voter screen that Marquette uses is it basically says you're absolutely certain you're going to go vote in the fall. And I think there are a lot more Democrats who are making it through the screen at this point who say they're absolutely certain they're going to vote in the fall versus Republicans are a lot less certain given what their candidate has said over the past few weeks.
As a person who tracks polls closely, Harry, what do you tend to focus on more, those registered voter or likely voter screens? And also in this particular presidential race, are you more interested in Trump or Clinton or Trump, Clinton, Johnson, Stein questions?
I think that's a great question. First off, at 538, we do keep track of Gary Johnson's poll numbers, so we prefer a three- or four-way. Some pollsters, in fact, in some states, Jill Stein's not even on the ballot, so, you know, in those cases, it'd be a three-way. So we prefer those numbers. In terms of the registered versus likely, we do keep track of likely voter numbers, but I think it's important to point out that it's still early, and traditionally in presidential years, there doesn't tend to end up being that wide of a gap between the two of them. So, you know, I'm looking and I'm saying, okay, at those registered voter numbers, that seems about right, whereby, you know, Clinton is up by 10 among registered voters in the head-to-head. That seems perfectly in line with the national polls that we're seeing, which is basically Clinton up, say, about 8 or 9 points in Wisconsin, being slightly to the left of the nation as a whole.
The Senate race here in Wisconsin, poll numbers out there, too. Democrat Russ Feingold, 11 points over Republican Ron Johnson, again, among likely voters there. How does that fit into what you're seeing in the national Senate picture?
Well, this is basically fitting in very nicely, which is that the Republican candidates for Senate are tend to be running a few points ahead of where Donald Trump is running in a given state. But unfortunately for Ron Johnson in the state of Wisconsin, Trump is so far behind that he'd have to be running well ahead of him to really have too much of a fighting chance at this point. Now, of course, it's still early, so these numbers could tighten up a bit. But if you look at the polls that have been taken this entire year, I don't believe there's been a single poll that has Russ Feingold trailing Ron Johnson. And this, to me, is a prime pickup opportunity for the Democratic Party. And the spending, or lack thereof, by certain both third-party outfits as well as the DSCC and NRSC also tend to point that this is probably not going to be where the real battleground is. This is probably a Democratic pickup.
I was going to ask you about that spending. Are we at a stage where donors are looking at numbers like this in the presidential and the Senate race and thinking, my money's better spent elsewhere?
I think absolutely so. I think that most people who are, you know, especially on the Senate side, are looking at this and going, we need to maintain our Senate majority, and there are better places to help maintain it than Wisconsin, which along with Illinois, with Mark Kirk in the, just to the south of Wisconsin, are probably going Democratic. I think that there are better seats such as Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, among others, where I think Republicans have a better chance of building a firewall to try and protect their Senate majority.
We're talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at some of the latest news from the presidential campaign trail. Moving on from the polls for a bit, after a rough week last week, I think people agreed, Donald Trump had a more on-message speech on Monday, looking at the economy in Detroit. And then there was this yesterday.
Hillary wants to abolish, essentially abolish, the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But
so a lot of reaction to that, Harry. People saying anything from that sounds like he's advocating for someone to shoot Hillary Clinton or Supreme Court judges. A lot of people, including Paul Ryan, thinking a joke gone bad. Trump supporters saying, no, he's talking about election action, political organizing. Once again, though, Trump supporters, based on something Donald Trump said, are playing defense again.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the consistent theme of this campaign, right? You know, you have Donald Trump, who isn't that well-liked. You have Hillary Clinton, who isn't that well-liked. They would both be better off if the campaign was focused on the other candidate, but it consistently is being focused in on Donald Trump. And look, I don't think that anyone thinks that Donald Trump wants someone to go out and shoot Hillary Clinton. But, you know, this is something that isn't taken lightly. You know, the Secret Service has spoken to the Trump campaign. I mean, this is just another distraction and keeps the focus on Donald Trump and away from Hillary Clinton and not on the issues. And there's a reason why Donald Trump at this point is the least liked presidential candidate on record. It's statements like that.
Yeah, opposition research, I guess, for the Clinton campaign is just watching what Donald Trump says if he keeps saying things that are going to get caught up like that.
I mean, someone literally did make a montage of clips and put it on YouTube of 4 minutes of just Donald Trump speaking, and they can just put it back to back to back to back to back to back to back. Usually you have to cut the clips out and try and make it seem like they said something they didn't. But with Trump, you just play the clips as is, and it makes him look like he's, you know, out of control. And there's a reason why the polls show that on the question of being a commander-in-chief or having the right temperament to serve as president, Hillary Clinton consistently leads Donald Trump. Even if voters don't like Hillary Clinton and perhaps thinks that she isn't full with the truth all of the time, you know, to quote Michael Bloomberg, they want a credible, sane leader. And Donald Trump, at least in the eyes of most voters at this point, isn't that.
Right. With Hillary Clinton, we still have a steady drip of email-related stories, the hacked accounts, differing with the FBI investigation on whether she was truthful. Now emails coming out showing maybe nothing at a criminal level, but things that people find unsavory about links between the Clinton Foundation and her State Department emails. If Donald Trump took a break for a bit, these things probably would be dominating the headlines, wouldn't they?
That's right. Look, the media wants a competitive race. See, this is the old-fashioned thing that I think a lot of people don't understand. They think the media may be biased towards one candidate and another. That may be so, but the true bias is they want people to tune in, and the way you get people to tune in is if there's the appearance of a competitive race. So they want balance in the media between Trump and Clinton. The problem is that Trump doesn't allow these stuff that Clinton has said or the scandals that she has been involved in to come to the forefront, and there's plenty of dirt on Hillary Clinton. There's a reason why she isn't well-liked by most Americans, but the problem is that Trump steps on his own message and doesn't allow the media to put forth the case against Clinton, and so all we really get is hearing bad news about Donald Trump, which is part of the reason why Hillary Clinton leads this campaign right now, including in the state of Wisconsin.
I want to get into a couple different issues here. You recently wrote about the idea that's out there that polls are skewed. Now, this came up 4 years ago. Mitt Romney supporters saying all these polls showing Barack Obama leading, they're skewed. We'll help you out and unskew them for you. We're starting to see that again. Are the polls skewed, Harry?
They are not skewed. Look, the polls could be wrong. They could be wrong. They weren't wrong in the primaries. Remember, Donald Trump, it was people like myself who didn't believe the polls, which is why we were skeptical about Trump. But the polls, in fact, showed Trump winning the entire time. If you look at the polls from all of the different outfits, they tell a very consistent picture. These polls are not skewed. They're not going to be professionals who are putting their livelihoods on the line here and try and, you know, have polls that just don't make any sense. All of the polls tell the same thing. There isn't a single national poll right now that has Donald Trump ahead. There's a reason for that, and that is because he is, in fact, trailing.
Are we going to see more Republicans? We have seen more Republicans. Senator Collins has said she's not voting for Donald Trump. With continued bad news in the polls, with continued statements from the campaign trail, confusing people at least, do you think we're going to see another steady drip of Republicans distancing themselves from Donald Trump?
Each Republican that distanced themselves from Donald Trump makes it easier for the next one to do so. You know, and then you're not just going on a limb on your own. We've even seen people who previously said they expected to endorse the nominee saying, wait a minute, Donald Trump still hasn't proven it to me. It should be pointed out that most Republicans at this point do support the nominee, but even if you're getting 80% of the Republican vote, which is about what Donald Trump gets in the Marquette poll, that in itself is far below expectations. You'd hope to get 90% plus among Republican voters. If Trump is stuck at 80%, he is going to lose this election. He needs that base behind him. And the more he talks out and the more statements that he makes, the easier it becomes for voters and for politicians to say, you know what, I'm a Republican, but Trump is a step too far for me.
And Harry, I almost forgot to ask, it looks like we have a new presidential candidate, sort of, this Evan McMullen, often followed by a who question mark, but he was a Republican congressional staffer. He's got some support, apparently, from Mitt Romney backers to try to get onto the ballot in some states, including states like Utah, where the thought is maybe he would draw off votes to help derail Donald Trump's chances in one or two states. Do you see that having an impact?
I mean, look, it gives some people an opportunity to vote their conscience. I don't think that we'll be saying the name Evan McMullen a lot. But in Utah, look, Gary Johnson has also based his campaign there. Mormon voters who make up the vast majority of the voters in that state do not like Donald Trump. It's historically a very Republican state, but Trump is struggling. No poll has gotten him above 40% so far in a state that Mitt Romney won 72% in 2012. I wouldn't be shocked if McMullen or Johnson made a play in Utah and the winning candidate, whoever wins Utah's electoral votes, ends up winning with less than 40% of the vote. It's probably still going to be Donald Trump, but hey, McMullen, Johnson, Clinton, Trump, looks like we could have a nice four-way race on our wet hands in that particular state.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an education expert about the 40th anniversary of the attempted desegregation of Milwaukee's public schools. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a reporter covering Brazil's Olympics tells us that the international media is focusing too much on the negatives of life in Brazil. First, we're only a couple weeks out from a new school year, which is the 40th anniversary of the court-ordered desegregation of Milwaukee public schools. In 1976, a federal judge ruled that Milwaukee schools were illegally segregated and ordered the school board to immediately take steps to integrate schools. The board appealed the decision, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ordered a new trial. The case was finally settled in 1979. The school board agreed to implement a five-year desegregation plan. Alan Borsig says the problems haven't gone away and are actually, in some ways, worse now. He's with us to talk about the desegregation anniversary. He's a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He writes a weekly column from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on education. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's go back to the late 1970s. Ultimately, this ruling does go through saying Milwaukee schools have to be desegregated. What was the plan that they came up with? What did they try to end segregation in the schools?
Well, the busing did start in September of 76, and it was phased in over the next few years. And it was a plan that was heavily dependent on two things. One was busing, and one was creating a set of schools, magnet schools, specialty schools. The term magnet was mostly used at that time. That would be so attractive that white parents and white kids would be willing to go to them, even if they were in African-American sections of the city or schools that had previously had low achievement levels. And so it transformed the landscape, ultimately.
And you write that one of the reasons that desegregation had trouble was that a lot of the white families left the city itself, went out into suburban areas. Was that a reaction in part to the desegregation order?
Well, there are probably a lot of factors involved, but there's no question that schools were a big part of it and desegregation was a big part of it. In the subsequent years from, say, 1975 to 1990, I've seen the number. It's enormous. It's like 250 to 300,000 white people moved out of the city and moved into the suburbs. The black population of Milwaukee was increasing rapidly at that time, and we were just in the early stages of what's become a huge demographic change for Milwaukee, which is the rise of the Hispanic community. But the whites basically, and I'm being a little blunter here than maybe I should be, but the whites basically didn't stick around. A few schools, yes, a few neighborhoods, yes, but overall, in 1976, Milwaukee Public Schools, two-thirds of the students were white. Within a few years, that went below 50%, and these days it's more like 10 to 12%.
Paint a picture now of Milwaukee when it comes to segregation in the schools. What do things look like?
That's such an interesting question because so little has actually changed. There was a period in the late 70s into the early 80s where a lot of the schools actually had quota systems, how many white kids, how many black kids. Even some of the best schools in town had waiting lists if you were black and you could get in easily if you were white. And then that whole desegregation, integration era pretty much faded away. I think that's true nationwide. There's almost no impulse to do that, not from anywhere, not from the higher income, lower income communities in Milwaukee, white, black, Latino. So the large number of the largest number by far of schools in Milwaukee, whether they're private, whether they're independent charters, or whether they're in the Milwaukee public school system, have overwhelming makeup, student body makeup of one race, be it white, black, Hispanic, or in a couple cases, Hmong. There's a high school on the northwest side, or a K-12 school on the northwest side of Milwaukee that has 1,200 students, of whom almost every one of them is Hmong. So it's very interesting picture, and nobody complains about it. Nobody agitates about it. Legally, it's a whole different era as well. But segregation is just a plain fact of life in schools in Milwaukee, with some exceptions.
Right. I wanted to say, in many of these schools, it sounds like I could walk in and say, ah, this is a black school, or this is a white school, or this is a Latino or Hmong school. You write that there are a few exceptions. What are those?
Well, a couple of the charter schools, a couple of the specialty schools with an MPS that do attract a more diverse population. There's a charter, an independent charter school, very excellent school called Woodlands, that intentionally has positioned itself in one of the few neighborhoods in Milwaukee where you can expect to draw a mixed population, and they consider that a goal and a point of pride for them. But there aren't many. At the high school level, it's a little bit more because the high schools draw from such wide areas. At the kindergarten through eighth grade level, very few schools that are racially mixed.
Talking to Alan Borsuk, he writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. 40th anniversary this school year of court-ordered desegregation in Milwaukee. As we're hearing, the schools still look pretty segregated. And Alan, I wanted to ask about the quality of the education before, you know, the 60s, the Jim Crow era, the idea was separate but equal, the argument anyway, that, yeah, white people, black people go to different schools, but they're equal schools. Clearly they weren't. Lower quality facilities in every single way imaginable for the most part. How about now? I mean, is a kid at what we could probably call a black school getting the same quality of education as the kids at the white school?
By race, I don't think it's as clear cut. By income, it is. Schools in low-income communities, for whatever reasons, and some of it isn't simply dollars, but they just don't have the resources, the capacities, the facilities that schools in higher-income communities do, and I'm talking about the suburbs as well. A lot of the school buildings in the city of Milwaukee are in good condition but very old. Class sizes are much larger than in a lot of the suburban communities, among other problems. And simply, you know, if you put me in front of a door of a school and I'm locked into it, I bet I could tell you pretty quickly whether I was in the suburbs of the city, and the difference would be the suburban schools are much nicer.
You wrote about something that I hadn't heard much about before, people looking at the idea of desegregating not by race, but by income level or socioeconomic status. As you were just saying, there are low-income schools, higher-income schools. Is this a conversation that's happening in Milwaukee?
No. I wish it were, frankly. No, there's really... It would probably involve more integration between the city and the suburbs, and there's very little interest in doing that as a policy thing, as a matter of... carrying out the state's open enrollment law. It goes on all the time, but that's on an individual basis, and it actually doesn't serve to integrate schools either by race or by income. But as a policy discussion, nobody's interested in here. But there are places in the country where it's a hot subject. Some of it is as simple as redrawing school district boundaries or the boundaries for individual schools, so you have much more of a mix of white kids and low-income kids and higher-income kids. The first project in the country like this goes back to, I believe it's 1979, and was in La Crosse. It involved the two high schools in La Crosse, one of which was definitely more high-income and academically more ambitious. And they just sort of redrew the boundaries and the application processes so that the populations on either side of the river, I believe it is, that separated them in La Crosse. And that's kind of faded out, but it was a pretty noble effort, and it did have impact. So you're seeing that pop up now in a lot of cities in the country where there are efforts to create more diverse student bodies. There's research that shows pretty persuasively that low-income kids benefit from being in a economically mixed atmosphere, and that there's no penalty to higher-income kids. It isn't like there's a downside. And it's actually much cheaper, according to some researchers, than an actual busing program or some other things, which are quite expensive. So the appeal of economic integration is pretty high. It's also legal, which race-based plans are generally not being approved by courts anymore.
In Milwaukee, we said this court order back in 1976, these efforts coming some years, starting then and going some years after. Was Milwaukee behind the curve on desegregation when we had this wave of efforts to desegregate schools?
Well, it was probably in kind of the middle of the pack. That was a time when court-ordered desegregation was going on all across the country. In some places, such as Boston, Louisville, it was far more tumultuous, disruptive, even violent. Milwaukee never had that kind of violence attached to a court-ordered desegregation into busing. It was actually implemented quite peacefully, one of the reasons being that generally white kids were given a lot more latitude to choose, and black kids were the ones who were pretty much ordered onto buses. So the opposition from the white community, like you had in Southie in Boston, didn't occur here. But a lot of people in the black community eventually came to resent this very much, that it was what became known as white benefit. The whole plan was geared to white benefit. Politicians like the late Polly Williams was just on the rise at that point. She served in the legislature for many years. She felt very strongly that it was just wrong that black kids had to go to white schools, so to speak, to get a decent education, and that the black community needed to demand high-quality schools in its own midst. And that struck a chord with a lot of people.
We're talking to education expert Alan Borsuk now about the 40th anniversary of the court-ordered desegregation of Milwaukee public schools. What changed since then and what hasn't? We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the desegregation efforts in Milwaukee's public schools 40 years ago, up to 35 years ago or so? How did it affect you? How diverse is your local school today? What do you think about the school where your kids or grandchildren go? What needs to change, if anything, to help diversify Milwaukee Public Schools or your schools wherever you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up on our discussion now with education expert Alan Borsuk about the 40th anniversary of the court-ordered desegregation of Milwaukee Public Schools. You can join us at 800-642-1234. How diverse was the school you went to, your kids go to? Do you remember the desegregation efforts in Milwaukee 40 years ago? What did you think at the time? What do you think looking back? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Mike on the line in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon. I worked at the Villard Avenue School at that time. And Dr. Stucker, who was in the sociology department at UWM, was my professor. I took statistics from him. And he and Judge Reynolds were the ones that were instrumental in getting that thing done. And then right after it got done, Dr. Stucker made sure that he moved out of here. You know, he was worried. But I worked at Villard Avenue School, and I watched that school go from a well-disciplined, well-organized school with really good teachers and good kids into absolute chaotic. You know, I can't express it enough. The whole school went down the tubes, and I was there at the time when that happened. Discipline just fell apart. These kids were ill-prepared to integrate anything. You know, there should have been some sort of an interim program for them.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Alan, the idea that the kids, maybe the parents too for that matter, the teachers weren't ready for integration when it started happening. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of ways to look at that, some of which are a little more constructive than others. The reading achievement levels among low-income kids and disproportionately among African-American kids were low at that time. They're low to this day. And that makes it difficult to make progress in a school setting when kids aren't reading on the grade levels they ought to be at. The percentage of kids who are coming from homes that are really not allies of the school, and I'm trying to be careful in how I phrase that, disproportionately dysfunctional homes, is very high, and that shows up in school too in terms of behavior and just the ability to execute a plan to carry out the structure of the school is hard when you got a lot of kids who aren't very structured. So these are legitimate issues. Did white people leave the city at that time because of racism, because of legitimate concerns about the academic content of the schools their kids would have been going to, because of class discrimination? Frankly, and I could get in trouble for saying this, I think it was all of the above. There were reasons not to go to some schools because of the academic atmosphere, and what happened at the school Mike was talking about, I bet is basically an accurate description if you looked at it as objectively as you could.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go next to Cheryl in Conover. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm born and raised on the east side of Milwaukee, and all I got to say to you is this. The only way you integrate a school system is if you integrate a town. And Milwaukee is not integrated, never has been, never will be, and still isn't today. So unless Milwaukee is going to change, you cannot change a school system. You cannot take these kids and expect them to be integrated when their parents never were.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. And people point toward a serious segregation in Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area. Alan, is that really a fatal obstacle if you want to integrate the schools?
Well, I don't know if it's fatal, but it's certainly still a highly segregated community as a whole. But on the other hand, overall, Milwaukee has a very diverse population, a very rich array of cultural influences and so on, and much more so than, dare I say, the state of Wisconsin, that, you know, if you go outside the city, especially if you get beyond, say, the closer in suburbs of Milwaukee, which are becoming more integrated both residentially and in terms of their schools, and then certain places like, you know, Madison, Beloit, Racine, Green Bay, some. Wisconsin is a very segregated state. You've got lots and lots of schools and school districts out there that are nearly 100% white to this day. And, you know, you can't just point to Milwaukee and say it's all your fault.
Talking to Alan Borsuk about desegregation in Milwaukee schools, 40th anniversary as the school year starts of court-ordered desegregation there. We'll go next to Al in Wauwatosa. Al, hi.
Well, hi, Alan. I read your column often in the paper, and my question is,
thanks.
In hindsight, again, it's always easy to look back, but what if all the money that had been used to pay for busing and schools and gasoline, not to mention all those students' time on buses, what if that money had been used to raise the level of the neighborhood schools themselves?
Al, thanks for the call. And Alan, you write about neighborhood schools in a follow-up piece to the one that triggered this discussion. What do you think?
Well, that's a really, really good question because it's an alternate universe that nobody knows. It's a painful question to answer. The fact that so many kids are so far behind in reading, and I think that really is a point to focus on, and they're ill-prepared for school when they get to four-year-old kindergarten, five-year-old kindergarten, just means they're at a disadvantage that is so hard to overcome. And it is really a fair question, what can schools do about it? So what if all the effort that went into integration had gone into raising reading levels, to helping kids get a fair start in the birth to four-year-old periods, or other changes like that? I don't know. It's certainly something you can dream about.
Al, thanks for the call. And Alan, in that follow-up piece I mentioned on the idea of neighborhood schools, there's sort of conflicting ideas in a way.
If
we move students around to mix up the schools, integrate schools a little better, that's maybe a positive. If we allow more choice, and there has been a lot of choice, letting parents pick their kids' schools, well, there's upsides to that. But then you're losing, in both of those cases, that community attachment to that school down the street or a few blocks away, where your neighbor kids, your neighbor parents are both involved in the same school.
I always reserve the right to contradict myself, even within the same column.
Well, I mean, the issue kind of
you're right. In that column, I was throwing out things that were contradictory. That there's things about neighborhood schools that are so great. My own kids and grandkids have gone to what I would call the neighborhood schools, and they are in some ways so much a way of separating us. The percentage of school kids in Milwaukee who are going to their neighborhood school is very low. With an MPS, it's under 20% that are going to what you would call their neighborhood school, because there's choice all over the place. There's private school choice. There's charter schools. Within MPS, there's a huge amount of choice. So the neighborhood school is really an oddity in Milwaukee, and they have great strengths. So there are some efforts to try to build that up. There's so little being done that actually integrates anything that I'd kind of say, well, neighborhood schools, we don't have much choice but to try to build them up because that's what we have, or at least schools that have communities of their own, even if kids are choosing to go there. But these are the schools we have. We need to work with them.
Alan, with the achievement gap issues you've referred to here, with the school quality issues in Milwaukee that people are trying to fix, is integration, is desegregation just off the radar, even though it was such a hot, huge issue of just 40 years ago?
Well, there are places where there is more in certain suburbs, Brown Deer, Wauwatosa, West Allis, some of the North Shore suburbs, Shorewood, Whitefish Bay, a little bit on the South Shore. You're seeing much more diverse populations in those suburban schools because there's been some migration of Black and Hispanic families, Asian families into those communities, and also because of open enrollment. But nonetheless, integration per se is not happening. And as I said, open enrollment actually increases the segregation of Milwaukee, that the 60% of the kids who open enroll out of the city of Milwaukee into suburban schools
are white, which means that leaves a smaller number of white kids in the city in reality. So and there ain't much of an integration movement. And Chapter 220, which was the voluntary suburban city integration program that goes back to the 1970s, is definitely fade away now. The legislature's cut off all new enrollment. The only kids who are in Chapter 220 now are kids who were already in those schools. So another few years, that'll be gone.
We'll leave it there for now. Alan, thanks, as always, for talking to us.
Glad to be here. Hope this is helpful.
That's Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. He writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on education. Join us to talk about the 40th anniversary this school year of the court-ordered desegregation of Milwaukee public schools and what's happened in the 40 years since that. You can find a link to his column and continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search for Central Time on WPR on Facebook. We're in the midst of the Olympics. There's a ton to watch. My kids are having a lot of fun. A lot of the big events are during the day, but they're being delayed for broadcast until primetime, which is great. We can watch it after work. Just one problem, avoiding spoilers. Chris Molina is in the midst of that dilemma. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob. So all I wanted to do when I got home from work last night is I wanted to watch the women's team gymnastics final. It's like my Super Bowl, happens once every 4 years. And I tried really, really, really hard to avoid any spoilers. But they're everywhere. I mean, you know, when it's tape delayed by even just a couple of hours, there's really no avoiding it. So the thing that got me yesterday was, you know, I was trying to stay off Facebook, but even in the little bar where you can update your status, it said right there, it's like, hey, the women won gold. Tell your friends how you're feeling about it. And I saw that and I went, dope.
It's really hard, especially in a media job like ours, where we're tracking a lot of what's going on in the media. I used to have this when I worked early. There'd be a Monday night Packer game. I'd videotape it. That tells you how long. On the VCR.
We don't need to
planning to watch it and trying to not see it on a newspaper online. Almost impossible.
It really is. And now that, you know, like social media and the internet, it's everywhere. It's so hard to do. I wish I could do it. I wish I could avoid it, but it seems like losing battle.
What are you going to watch tonight?
Oh, man, whatever's on, I think it's going to be a lot more swimming, and I don't know the results on that.
Excellent. I'll find them and tell you before
Thank
we leave
you.
Work today. That's Chris Molina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.